the Senate Revenue Committee. Senator Starr, thank you for filling in for me. I'm finally back in the saddle.
Well, glad to have you back, Senator Decker. It's not good to have these late winter spring colds.
I got a good one, too. I had my first cup of coffee this morning in a week.
Oh, wow.
Kind of forcing it down, but it's good to be back. So we will... Well, let's go ahead and get started on 171 and request Senator George and Senator Pozanski, if they can hear us, that we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 171. Paul, do you want to talk to us, and then I'll hand it off to Senator Metzger.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the A engrossed bill that you have before you came over to you from Senator Metzger's committee with incorporating the three recommendations of the PUC. And those recommendations appear in Section 3 of the bill, is the first recommendation regarding consolidated federal returns. Recommendation number 3 is the 5-year time period for the commission to order a new filing for general rate revision. That was recommendation number 3. And then recommendation number 2 was the additional information that the PUC would get and would incorporate into its decisions. Actually, it shows up most explicitly right at the end of the bill, the end of Section 8, that upon application, the PUC may authorize incorporation into rates of estimated federal and state taxes. So that was recommendation number 2 of the 3 recommendations from the PUC. Now, you have before you 3 amendments. The Dash 7 amendment cleans up the language in Section 3, but does not change the content other than excluding from consideration water districts. We have a list of a large number of water companies that would fit under the definition of ORS 757.005. So you're essentially, what this would do is relegate the bill to utilities that are involved in electricity or natural gas. So that's the Dash 7s. The Dash 8s does that same thing regarding the elimination of the water utilities, but it also eliminates pages 3 through 5 of the bill, deletes them, which in effect limits the bill to just recommendation number 1 regarding the consolidated return. So,
okay, so this is your amendment.
A9, actually.
This is the A8, and which is all from Senator Metzger. And then the A9 replaces the A8 and then adds a section it also does the same thing as the A8 does, and the A7 for that matter. And it deletes the recommendations 2 and 3, and then has some language on page 3 regarding the acquisitions and factors that the PUC should take into account in those applications for acquisition.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Pozanski.
Paul, you said page 3 on the A9?
Yes.
I've got a page 1, page 2, and a page 4. So is there actually a page 3?
Yeah.
There. Oh, you're talking about
deletes.
Okay.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
But the A9 should have a page 3, though, too.
Yeah. No, I don't have a page 3. I've got 2 and I'm going to jump to 4.
Trust us.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good Rick language. You want to give him? You can have my copy. You can have my copy.
Okay. I'm sorry. Let's see if we've got. Barbara's checking over there to see if we've got.
Well, Senator Metzger, there should be a amendment, so he probably knows.
No. You want me to go?
Yeah, 2 and 4.
Yeah, Senator Starr's missing a page 3, too.
Mm-hmm. We need to get the page.
We need to get our microscopes out here. Mm-hmm. Magnifying glasses. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get a page 3.
Now, Barbara, we don't start removing the pages to the amendments till June. That's when we start doing that.
A chair is special here.
Where's page three? Senator Metzger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would ask Mr. Willis from PUC to come up while I'm talking. Colleagues, just want to go over just real briefly what these do. Mr. Willis may want to talk about the base bill. I know we haven't talked about that. We moved that that policy decision out of business on the cogen facilities, which was a department bill, and there was no opposition to that. The key elements that have been added here after our last hearing is that that are reflected in the dash A9s, as Mr. Warner pointed out, was I decided to eliminate recommendations 2 and 3 from the PUC because I felt all that did was add more objections to the issue regarding the federal tax considerations, regarding the 5-year mandatory look for a rate hearing. And includable in that now is simply the requirement that for electric utility companies, all the water companies are eliminated, so we're just talking about the electric utilities in the A9. And you heard from the discussion we had before, and that is when the PUC sets the rates for these utilities, they look at the utility as if it is a standalone corporation with no unregulated business interests either here or outside the state of Oregon. And they look at it as a standalone company, and they're allowed to collect taxes from the ratepayers based on only their regulated activities in Oregon. But what has happened is that while they are allowed to collect from taxpayers those taxes, when they go to file their returns, they are then allowed to consolidate with other business interests, unregulated interests they may have in other states, and essentially use Oregon tax dollars to offset those, and so that the Treasury never gets the money that the taxpayers paid. So this simply says you are allowed to collect taxes based on a standalone company, and we want you to file them as a standalone company. And then the other element in the A9 that was added is the essentially the ruling by the PUC that if anybody wants to acquire an electric utility, that they have to have a net benefit to the ratepayer with no harm to the public at large. That is a ruling by the PUC. We felt it was good to put it into statute because it hadn't been challenged yet. It was used very effectively, you might remember, colleagues, in the TPG case. And we feel by having it in statute would give the PUC the proper legal authority for their ruling. So this is good customer and ratepayer legislation, and I think it's the right thing to do. And the reason, by the way, we put the net benefit standard in this bill. I had that in Senate Bill 671, which the folks from the Oregon Mutual Utility are working, and because of the future of that is uncertain, I didn't want that in this important public benefit statute to get lost in that discussion. And that's why I included it here, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, any questions for Senator Metzger, since he's put together the three amendments that are before the committee, before we turn it over to the good Mr. Willis? Good Mr. Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think the bill has been explained fairly well. Just to walk through it quickly and give you the commission's perspective on it. The first piece is requiring the utilities to file standalone deconsolidated income tax returns. Commission supports that. That was part of the recommendation that the commission had made on this tax issue. It would then have the monies that customers pay in their rates actually go to the state treasury for state taxes. The second part is it kind of codifies.
We just need to get your name for the record.
Forgive me, Rick Willis with the Public Utility Commission. The second piece of it codifies in state statute the net benefit standard, and as Senator Metzger mentioned, that is a standard that we currently use. It's an administrative rule, administrative law that we use, and we think it would be helpful to have it put in the state statute so that it's very clear that this is a standard that we follow, and again, this commission supports that piece. And the third part of the bill is the part that started out in 671, and that is to correct it's a ministerial error. And it reinstates an exemption for small cogeneration facilities and small power plants from regulation by the PUC. Mm-hmm. And obviously we support that as well.
Right.
So we are supportive of the bill.
And you've seen all of the A7s, A8s, and are very familiar, it sounds like, with them. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have, and we're comfortable with them.
Great. Questions for the PUC? Senator George.
I'm looking through this file, and I don't see, is there anyone else supporting this bill besides the PUC? Is there anyone else?
Is that a question for me?
I am.
You are. Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm not sure.
I can answer Senator George.
Senator
George. We have three parts here. We had all the cogen piece was supported by everyone in business committee, including the testimony. The UM 1011 net benefit standard had no opposition. And was supportive of that. The other third area, the deconsolidated tax return, was opposed by the two energy companies, Northwest Natural and PacifiCorp, and the City of Portland. Excuse me? Oh, okay. Well, and the City of Portland supports it. Oh, I'm sorry. The gallery says the City of Portland supports it. And we never had officially had PGE on the record. If PGE would like to go on the record, my understanding was they were neutral on that provision. But and the nod is yes. PGE is not
once
opposed,
again neutral,
but neutral.
Neutral
on that provision.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Sampson.
I wonder if we can get just a little bit more information about the cogen part as to what the parameters or what type of facilities we're talking about.
Yes, good point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, this came out of Senate Bill 1149 from the 1999 session. And as part of that huge bill, unfortunately, this piece got tweaked. And what these are small, like I say, cogen, small power facilities under 50 megawatts. And the idea is to provide an incentive for these small utilities to generate power and not have them under the full authority of the PUC. So they're smaller generating plants.
Thank you. Other questions or comments for the PUC? Thank you very much. Anyone else before? We're in work session, but if you'd like to, since these are new amendments, we've definitely debated most of these issues a great deal, but anyone else that would like to say anything to us before we... Great. Senator Metzger.
Senator Deckard, I move the -A9 amendments to Senate Bill 171.
Senator Metzger has moved the -A9 amendments to Senate Bill 171. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Just on the cogen, I understand that those smaller plants wouldn't be regulated at all, or just would have different regulations on the PUC.
I'm trying to remember from the bit. Mr. Willis, would you like to apologize?
Retreated too soon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, they would not come under the full rate regulation of the PUC. We would still exercise some safety regulation over those smaller plants.
Okay.
Make sure that there's not a public safety issue.
And if these are new plants that are coming online, is there a process for the public to be heard from in giving testimony at any type of hearings?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, for any siting of a new facility, yes, there is a public process that goes through the Department of Energy and their energy siting facilities group.
Okay.
That has a public process for that, yes.
Right. One last question, if I could.
Please, yeah.
Regarding these facilities, I should say this component that's within the bill, what I heard you say earlier, Mr. Willis, was that this was something that may have not been fully included or elaborated on in the 1149 for 1999 bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct. They had not been regulated previously through a error in 1149 that, if you recall, that was a huge bill and just nobody caught it. They inadvertently fell under regulation.
Completely.
Yes. And so this bill takes them back to where they were originally.
Okay.
Other discussion or questions? Paul.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make a comment regarding the revenue impact. I will release a statement for you, basically, that it's indeterminate, given that the taxpayers involved all file consolidated returns. So there will be years in which, obviously, the revenue would be positive, but there could be years where it's negative, too, depending on the overall profitability of the consolidated group. So in terms of revenue impact itself, I'll issue one that discusses that issue, but there won't be any numbers assigned to it because of that uncertainty, given the number of companies that are currently filing under that same return.
Great. Maybe this is our solution to the budget gap that is vexing us so. Other questions, sir? Okay, thank you, Mr. Willis. Barbara, will you call the roll on the dash A9 amendments to Senate Bill 171?
Senator Jordan.
No.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Senator Posansky.
Aye.
Vice Chancellor Carr.
No.
Chair Deckard.
Votes aye. It's our adoption.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, I move House Senate Bill 171 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger's move Senate Bill 171 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I'm going to be supporting the motion at this point. I don't think I have a problem with it. One thing I do want to check is on the cogeneration part. I know there's some smaller facilities that are coming up online or have been proposed, some that are in my community, and I just want to make sure that it's not going to have some type of adverse effect that they would be more concerned with. But I think it sounds fine from what I've heard. But I just want to say I'll move it now, and I'll let the chair and Senator Metzger know if anything should change. But I don't expect it to.
Great. Other discussion on, yes, Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still concerned that I don't even as amended, don't see any advantage of ratepayers, and I'm really concerned that what this may do is have a chilling effect on anyone who may want to invest in power generation in Oregon and distribution. So I'll be a no vote.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Do you want to get it? Barbara, please call the roll.
Senator George.
No.
Aye.
Senator Posansky.
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr.
No.
Chair Deckard.
Votes aye. The bill passes to the Senate floor, and Senator Metzger will carry that bill. Okay, so let's do reconnect. Lisbeth, you're going to walk us through the highlights of the most fascinating issue we get to deal with every 2 years, which is reconnecting to the federal tax code.
We also have LinkedIn if you wanted to testify and get a chance to.
I'm going to bring Link up. Link, you want to testify, and then we'll go with Lisbeth. So I'm going to open a public hearing on 2542, and Lisbeth, if it's okay with you, I'll let Link testify since he didn't get in. You're welcome to stay there. Although, knowing Link as well as I do, I would move.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Lincoln Cannon. I'm the Director of Forest Resources and Taxations for the Oregon Forest Industries Council, OFIC. I apologize for not being here Tuesday. In addition to my official title, I'm also our network IT guy, and we had some network problems Tuesday morning. So I was trying to get our email working, which we did successfully, but I missed the hearing. So,
well, you know,
so I'm here today.
The tax status of all your members or the email system, I can see where the emails take priority on.
Well, it's we're so connected nowadays. It's pretty important when you get disconnected. So
good analogy.
And I knew I could be here Thursday because I knew there was still a public hearing. Mr. Chair, I've talked to, spent the last couple of weeks talking to the accountants and CFOs of our member companies, and the concern I hear repeatedly is with regards to this bill is the onerous and costly accounting problems that it would create by having to keep two sets of books. You've heard about this from the CPAs and others. I put in my written testimony a specific example related to forestry, which is how reforestation costs are treated under the federal code, under the change made in the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. Companies are allowed to expense the first $10,000 of reforestation expenses and then amortize over 84 months qualified reforestation expenditures above and beyond that, where at the state level they cannot expense, and they're required to amortize the first $10,000 and then capitalize, I believe, beyond that. So it's just in this little tiny provision. It's a very complicated bookkeeping maneuver that goes on over the entire period of rotation of trees. And you heard from the CPAs and DOR, even on this provision, the CPAs had this as part of their automatic reconnect in Section A of their report that they gave you, where the DOR says, no, that's not an automatic reconnect, which is how we had interpreted it. And so, you know, this kind of confusion, just in this is one example, and there are many, many examples in other businesses like this. So this is a big concern, and one reason we feel very strongly that there needs to be a reconnect. The other piece I've touched on here is you heard testimony that the particularly with regards to the American Jobs Creation Act, that the qualified production activities income and extraterritorial income exclusion pieces of that act are somehow should be considered separately and were related. And what I did yesterday was looked at the bill, which is a book. It is 9 titles, almost 200 sections. I counted 194. I only did it once. I wasn't going to go back and count over and over. But it's a very lengthy bill, and the first section of the bill deals with one subject area and two sections. Or the first title of the bill, excuse me. And this is a quote from the bill. Title 1 is provisions relating to the repeal of exclusion for extraterritorial income. Section 101 repeals the exclusion for extraterritorial income, and Section 102 creates a deduction relating to income attributable to domestic production activities. So it's clear, I think, from a simple reading of the bill, what Congress intended, which was that was a trade-off. You lost the extraterritorial income exclusion, and you got in return, and different taxpayers were affected differently, but you got in return the domestic activities production deduction. Our members are both winners and losers under this. People used the exclusion that's now gone, and people use the manufacturing deduction that now exists. So to us, it was a trade-off, not one or the other or separate things that weren't connected. And then I guess the final point was, and you'll hear from your staff on this morning, but at least as of the last revenue impact analysis that I saw, a total reconnect, and that's including not only the things that would be reconnected by the passage of this bill, but if you include all the automatically reconnected pieces, it's a wash to a positive revenue impact, and that's how we think it ought to be looked at. We believe that this bill is good tax policy, and that it ought to, that you ought to pass it. So we're in full support of the bill.
Do you, Link, do you have on medical savings accounts, do you have members who are utilizing that?
On health savings accounts?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I honestly have not talked to folks about that, so I can't respond. I'd be happy to get the information and get back to you.
I'd be interested if you have any of your members that are utilizing that provision, the health savings account provision of the reconnect, or the federal one.
Senator, I will get that information to you.
All right, thank you. Other questions for Mr. Cannon? Yes, Senator George.
Mr. Cannon, thank you. Did you get a chance to look at the minority report that was filed on the House side? And did your organization support that or oppose that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we did see the minority report and we opposed it.
So if provisions of the minority report were brought back, you'd be very strongly opposed to that, the bill in that form?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Other questions or thoughts from Mr. Cannon? Yes, Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your part of the testimony talking about we should look at this as an overall package and see it as a plus in the sense of what Oregon would be able to gain from that. Could you please elaborate on that? Because some of the opponents are saying we could actually retrieve or retain somewhere in the range, I believe, of $11 to $14 million of the programs that may not be fully funded. I just want to conceptually understand the perspective that overall this is good because we're going to somehow, I guess, come out of the plus side, or at least there's some opposition saying that's not the case.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, I guess our feeling is I think you could come up with more than $14 million. If you wanted to go through and add up all the pluses and the minuses and keep the pluses and lose the minuses, you could raise a lot more money. Or if you wanted to go back and disconnect from things that you've automatically connected, you know, there's a lot of ways to slice that pie to vary the revenue impact, and it's our feeling that you shouldn't do that. It's bad tax policy. It makes sense for us to be connected to the federal tax code, and if it's a revenue issue, this isn't the right way to go about raising revenues. You know, there are other ways to do that, and it just is sort of cherry-picking these individual things and disconnecting here and there. It just doesn't work very well, we don't think, as a revenue-raising mechanism.
I guess the other question is, as alternatives, tax expenditures, is that something that you think that this body should look at? Since we have 53, whatever it is, and seeing whether we should be raising revenue through a review of those that are on the books now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, I would say a lot of those are there for good reasons. The previous legislatures have evaluated those. I know I was here when, I'm not drawing a blank, but the House Revenue Committee, I can't remember, the chair, he's head of the League of Oregon Cities now. Yeah, Chairman Strobeck of the House Revenue Committee went through a review of a fairly exhaustive review of the tax expenditures, and I believe they got rid of one, which was fish cleaning or crop cleaning or something. So, sure, I mean, a review of those is always a good idea, but I think a lot of them are there, or most of them are there, or all of them are there, because the previous legislatures thought they were a good idea, but it's always within your purview to review that.
Strawbacks, that would have been 97 or 99.
99.
Thank you.
So, I don't know. I mean, this is somewhat rhetorical, but I'm not sure if I buy the notion that just because Congress enacted something, that Oregon automatically must be connected to it. And I don't know. I mean, we could, I guess, debate that. But to me, I'm not sold on that. Because Congress just made a decision, a policy decision, ultimately, with a fiscal attached to it, that Oregon's finances must, therefore, be, and would be happy to hear an alternative point of view to that.
Mr. Chair, it is a policy decision by Congress. I guess the only thing I would say is it was a carefully thought out and balanced decision that it was broad bipartisan support, including most of the Oregon delegation, if not all. I can't tell you the vote count, but I know it was bipartisan. And certainly it's within the purview of the Oregon legislature to make different policy decisions, but you know, we believe that it's good policy to stay fully connected to the tax code. That's always been, it's not a position that we just came by today. It's something we've always supported. So,
this is kind of a tough one, Mr. Cannon, but I'm going to throw it your way since there's no one in here and it's a Thursday morning. So Congress increased taxes on, you know, forest owners. Do you think you guys would testify and say we ought to automatically be connected to that policy just because it's the books are, we want to?
Well, Mr. Chair, in fact, they did under the by eliminating the extraterritorial income exclusion, they did increase taxes, and then by passing the production activities tax, and I'm just talking about those two pieces, they decreased them, and different companies are affected differently. Some utilized one provision a lot, and some didn't utilize it at all. And so it's whenever you change a tax law, you know, as an industry, we may or may not be net gainers or losers, but as individual companies, there are gainers and losers, and it's really a policy issue to us more than a revenue issue.
Okay. Any other thoughts or questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cannon. I don't think we have anyone else. Ms. Beth, do you want to walk us through?
So, Chairman Deckard and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with Legislative Revenue Office. So I gave you quite a few things on Tuesday, I guess, when we last heard it. I think I'll start with just going through the bill so everyone's clear exactly what's in the bill. So you've got a section-by-section analysis there of the bill. So basically, to begin with, with the Reconnect bill, what a common component in it each session is that you're changing all the current law Internal Revenue Code date-specific references. So right now in law, we have December 31st, 2002. We're changing all those to December 31st, 2004. And then the bill does make...
Elizabeth, can you show us the papers that you're...
Yeah. You guys have this one. It says section by section.
Is that the one that's bound together, probably?
Yeah, I would imagine they're probably bound together.
Yeah.
Maybe towards the back.
There's a two-pager front and back.
In the last.
Called section by section.
Well, I just, for whatever reason,
missed the numbers.
I don't have it.
Barbara.
Go ahead and.
Okay. I want to make sure everyone's clear. With House Bill 2542. We are going to be, moving up the connection date to December 31st, 2004 to connect to all these various federal legislations that you had in the CPA report. But in addition to that, you also are reestablishing that rolling reconnect to federal law. Now, that was a big decision that was made last session as far as temporary delaying that rolling reconnect. Remember, Chairman Deckard, that's why we have right now a kind of a specific connection for only certain components, and that be depreciation and then pensions and like the savings accounts and medical savings accounts. But what this is going to do is, and then we were going to reestablish that rolling reconnect, but not until 2006, January 1st, 2006. This brings the rolling reconnect back 1 year and begins it right now in January 1st, 2005. So what they're telling you is that if between now and when this bill gets placed into law, if there are any federal law changes, those will go into effect automatically. We will connect with those for the rest of the year. The only difference would have been is if you would have had some federal law change, say, in December 30th of 2005, you wouldn't have automatically connected to it under current law because that rolling reconnect didn't start until December 1st, 2006. So everyone...
Just on that point, so do we know of any, and we have two of our members are on the Finance Committee, any major tax legislation that they're... And when is the end date that you said we would be connected to anything until, I would assume, the next time this legislature convenes?
Okay. Now, so, Chairman Deckard, under current law, first of all, if you just pass this bill without reestablishing a rolling reconnect again in the future, you wouldn't be connected to federal law changes that happen throughout the rest of this year.
We'd be disconnected.
You'd be disconnected throughout December 31st, 2005. Then in January 1st, 2006, you would be connected. So, basically that was put into play last session a lot so that we would have this discussion again this session. Do you want to have that reestablished rolling reconnect again in the future or not? And so that was all part of it. Now, as far as your other question about federal legislation, I know Representative Boquist had, said that there was some pending legislation dealing with military compensation, and they may be increasing those death benefits and stuff beyond what they are in federal law right now. So that's the kind of thing you would be connecting to under this the rolling reconnect reestablishing January 1st, 2005. Now, if there are any other questions on that, I'll kind of move on. But that is a bigger policy issue for you in the bill. Now, with Section 1, then, we're just changing the date again for the Internal Revenue Code for the statutes pertaining to the definition of S-corporations. And then, and it adds a section on who can actually represent taxpayers in a conference with respect to taxes, and that's something the Department of Revenue wanted to bring forward. So that's what that section is in there. And then we, in Section 2, you've got just, again, date references to statutes pertaining to definitions of S corporations. And then in Sections 3 through 11, and then 13 and 15, those are all just, again, different sections in which they have a date-specific Internal Revenue Code, and it's just updating that date-specific from December 31st, 2002 to December 31st, 2004. And then it is, again, adding language that says, if related to the definition of taxable income, then Oregon law will connect automatically to federal law changes without, you know, needing further legislation passed in Oregon. So that's, you've got that rolling reconnect then establishing right away. And it also is deleting any of the language in our current statutes dealing with, we've now kind of got a partial automatic connections with those components like depreciation and pension changes and stuff. So it deletes all that because we don't need to have that, those components spelled out anymore because we have the automatic reconnect beginning again. And then in Section 12, we're connecting then to Oregon's definition for qualifying child to the federal definition under the Internal Revenue Code, and that was something that Senator Winters brought forward in a bill. And so this is basically connecting to a broad definition, and then it's going to be applying to our working family child care tax credit. So we will have this broader federal definition what child can actually be claimed as a dependent, and then also dealing with who can claim this as far as, you know, whether it can be a grandparent or not, or a step-parent. And then in section...
And what is the Oregon fiscal... I'm trying to find it on this sheet. What is the Oregon fiscal impact on that?
On that component. Okay. If you're looking on the the big sheet... Okay. This one. And then you got to go to the second page... Okay, where it says C, says recommendation C. So then from there, you got to basically look from the bottom up. I think that's the easiest way. You see where it says total revenue impact changes which need legislation. Right above that says allows grandparents and other relatives / guardians to claim the working family child care credit. Mm-hmm. So that's a reduction then of roughly $2.9 million in the 2005-07 biennium, $3 million in the 07-09 biennium, and then $3 million in 2009-11. So roughly $3 million. Do you see that, Senator Decker?
I do.
Okay.
I do. So on these, as we go section by section, I think it's good for us to know as we do the policy and the fiscal and marry those so that we kind of know,
sure,
as we hit each section what the policy decision was and then what the fiscal impact on Oregon would be.
Okay. And let's see, as far as another component, too, of section of the bill is Section 14. And we're also connecting to federal definition of child for the disabled child. And basically, that is, again, a broad definition of child. But the issue is under federal law, there is no age restriction on disabled child. And in Oregon's law, we did have an age, or we under current law, we have an age restriction, I think it's 18, on the disabled child for these early intervention services and things. So this recognizes that this is a bit of a policy change. This is a change in current law because you have an age restriction on disabled child in current law, but you would be eliminating that age restriction under your connection with federal law, which has no age restriction. So just so everyone's clear on that, too. Okay, then on... we've got some new add-back provisions in Oregon law in Section 14A and 14B. And this is requiring personal income tax payers to elect the same deduction, either sales tax or personal income tax, on their Oregon tax returns as was claimed on their federal return. Now, one major component of the American Jobs Act of 2004 was to allow those states that have sales taxes to choose between having a sales tax deduction or having an income tax deduction. And so at the federal level, so what we're doing when we're connecting then with those laws, and we have to decide, okay, here in Oregon, first of all, are we going to connect to this provision? And second of all, if we're going to connect, then are we going to allow taxpayers to have different deductions? You know, can they claim a sales tax at the federal level and then income taxes at, you know, the state level? And so this basically in the bill, the section 14A and B, is saying that it's requiring personal income tax filers to elect the same deduction at the federal level and at the state level. They either have to choose sales tax or they have to choose personal income taxes. And then from that, it's also saying that in Oregon, you know, at the federal level, if you choose, you know, to deduct your state income taxes, you're going to then add those back when you calculate Oregon's taxable income base. You have to add back. You can't have that deduction for your state taxes from your federal return then incorporated into your state return. It's added back. So this is having an add back also for the sales tax deduction. So this is just, you know, making the same treatment for sales taxes that you also are giving to income tax deduction. So this basically is going to be an additional revenue that we would be seeing here in Oregon, and that's on your sheet here, again, the second page, and we've got up there under, it's kind of hard to see, but under the American Jobs Creation Act, I've got civil rights tax relief, and then you've got sales tax in lieu of income taxes added back to Oregon taxable income. That's an additional $1.1 million in the 05-07 biennium. Now, the reason why it doesn't go on in the future is because it's only for 2 years.
So
it's,
why would Oregon benefit from, how do we benefit from this?
Yeah, and the reason is that basically it's low-income folks that would be, you know, who basically might not be paying very much in Oregon income taxes, but they say they're a Washington resident, they may have quite a bit in sales taxes. So then their sales taxes may be bigger than their income taxes. And so what they would be choosing sales taxes on the tax form at the federal level. So then here in Oregon, they could, if we didn't have an add back provision, then they would not only get that in on their federal return, but they'd also get it on their Oregon state return. Where under current law, they're just claiming income taxes and then they're adding them back. So we'd be losing revenue from those folks in both ways if you didn't have an add back in there. So it's basically targeting at non-residents who don't have much income tax liability here in Oregon. Right. Now, once you pay a lot of income taxes, you know, then it's you're going to be choosing income taxes over sales taxes as your deduction of choice. But I think the breakoff was right around 20,000, 25,000, somewhere in that range, where it flipped as far as basically assuming how much sales taxes you would be paying would be less than how much income taxes above 25,000. So that's how that provision is going to work. And then with Section 15A and B, it's the same thing, not just for personal income tax filers, but for corporate tax filers. And then in Section 16, these are establishing then basically kind of the implementation dates, which is going to begin on or after January 1st of 2005. It lists then the different federal legislation that has passed since December 31st, 2002 that we will be connecting to. It provides a mechanism for taxpayers to have interest or penalties canceled for tax deficiencies that are attributable to the federal tax law connection changes here in Oregon. And it also specifies that if a refund is due to a taxpayer for tax years beginning January 1st, 2005, due to any retroactive treatment, okay, from these federal law changes, then a refund will not be paid with interest. So it's basically just saying to the Department of Revenue, they do not have to pay these refunds with interest. And it's also clarifying that taxpayers must file an amended tax return for changes in Oregon law due to these federal law changes before December 1st, January 2005. And it also allows the Department of Revenue to make changes to tax returns that do not file amended tax returns within the time period specified under current law or within 1 year, whichever is later. Now, the other big issue in the bill is dividend received deduction, okay? And so that's Section 17 and then 18A through C. And basically what this is dealing with is I gave you this diagram here, and this is basically trying to give you at least a pictorial view of kind of an issue that we've been struggling with since the beginning of session, when kind of this issue was brought forward from the Department of Revenue. And, yeah. And they started, oh, do you guys not have this?
We do. That was going to be the tax.
You guys okay? Okay. So basically with this, Department of Revenue started looking at some of the dividends received. And they, it was part of a multi-state tax commission recommendation to states is to look at, in particular, real estate investment trusts, those REITs, and basically, you know, saying to states that, you know, it's not federal treatment to allow REITs to have any deduction. So you might want to check, you know, state statutes to see how you're treating REITs. And so that was originally how this issue kind of came forward. And so when, so that kind of then got us thinking about all the different types of corporate dividends received that we have, and then trying to look at the connection between federal law deduction allowability versus Oregon law deduction allowability. So basically that's what you're seeing here in the middle, is just these federal dividends, the different types of dividends that corporations could receive, and then how are they treated and how are we disconnecting. And the reason, you know, it's kind of hard to describe exactly why we're disconnecting in a variety of ways, but it's just, we've kind of had a long history of having a statute, and in particular came into be, I think, about the early 80s, as far as specifying out what are the dividends received that are excluded from having a deduction on a corporate tax return. So that statute kind of started taking precedent even when we started connecting to the federal law definition of taxable income for corporations. And so it never really kind of got examined whether or not there was a disconnect between federal law and then Oregon law. So that's what basically we've tried to clean up a bit in Section 17 and 18. Is in particular, I'll just highlight this bottom part here, in the dividends not receiving a federal deduction. So basically, under that box H there, the second to the last box, basically these are dividends that are not allowed any deduction at the federal level, but in Oregon, they're lumped into the dividends that received that are allowed a 70 or 80% deduction here in Oregon, and that's 70 or 80% depending on the amount of ownership of that particular corporation that's paying the dividends.
Okay, so Elizabeth, and I'm probably the only one here, but I'm just not following this. So
okay.
Can you set the stage of before you go to this diagram, okay, so okay. You have a REIT or a corporation that is receiving dividends.
Yeah. And Chairman Decker, it would be like a C corporation that's accepting, that's receiving dividends from a REIT, or it could be, you know, a foreign-controlled corporation. I mean, so that's why you see so many boxes, because there's so many different types of corporations that could be paying out a dividend to, you know, it could be a parent corporation or just, you know, because they own ownership in this particular corporation. So basically, the setting it up such that it's a C corporation that is actually going to be claiming the dividends received either at 100% or at some dividend deduction where they get a reduction then in the amount of dividends they actually have to claim in corporate taxable income.
On their federal tax form and their state tax.
Right. And the problem is it's not the same. So that's the thing. I mean, we many times think that, okay, our deductions are all the same, you know, as we went through orientation and everything, that we always were assuming that they're exactly the same, but they're not. So that's what we're trying to highlight here, is that the Oregon dividends received deduction does not always mirror and exactly parallel the federal dividends deduction. So that's what we're trying to highlight here, where are the differences, and the and the box H there is what we're dealing with in this bill, because this is ones in which clearly we have a big disconnect. I mean, at the federal level, they allow no dividends deduction at all for these dividends received, but in Oregon, we allow a 70 or 80% dividend deduction. And on the second page of this here, where I've got their box H, that lists out the different types of dividends that will be coming into the corporation. Dividends received from a REIT, the real estate investment trust. income from controlled foreign corporations. And so this is another reason why this kind of got highlighted, is because with the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004, one major component, one major plus in that federal legislation was to try to incent corporations to repatriate their earnings, foreign earnings, back to their parent corporation. Well, that's an income that becomes a dividend there, and under Box H, income from controlled foreign corporations. Well, at the federal level, they're going to give an 85% dividend deduction. Okay, just temporarily for 1 year.
So they get to deduct on that one 85% of, they start repatriating the income from a foreign controlled subsidiary, 85% is deductible at the
federal level. That's correct. And we have to decide, you know, with our American Jobs Creation Act connection, are we going to connect with that temporary deduction? But then also we have to decide, and that's what became kind of the illustration, is that we're already given a 70 or 80% dividend deduction, subtraction. Okay,
today,
under current law today.
We give 70 or 80%.
70 or 80%. So the issue is then in the future, are we going to connect to federal law and then not allow a dividend, 70 or 80% dividend deduction for those foreign earnings that are repatriated back to their parent corporation? So that's what Box H is all talking about. What we're doing in the bill in Section 17 and 18A through C is take everything in this Box H, the REITs, as well as the income from controlled foreign corporations, and in any of those dividends from tax-exempt organizations, and there's foreign dividends from gross-up taxes paid, and then DISs and things. And so all of that is going to then not be allowed a dividend deduction here in Oregon in the future. We will be mirroring then federal law as far as only not allowing any dividend deduction in the future after the provisions in the American Jobs Creation Act 2004.
Okay, well then I want to, if that's what's in Section 17, I'd like to just go through 1 through 9, just one by one, so that we really understand. And I think we got number 2 handled. So let's talk about the REIT if we could.
I'm sorry.
Number 1.
Okay. Yeah, so the real estate investment trust. So those are basically trusts that are set up for real estate, for property that are held. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it would be Oregon property. So it's only, but you could receive REITs. I mean, the corporation could have REITs from anywhere, you know, mm-hmm. but it could be property that's held in California. And then they're just they've taken ownership of this REIT, and so they're receiving dividends from that.
Okay, so I'm a C Corp. I have property in Palo Alto and in Bainbridge Island, Washington, and foreign also?
Sure.
Okay. And yeah. So as the dividends come in, mm-hmm. the federal law allows me to deduct what percent?
Right now, nothing. I mean, 100% is not deducted. It's 100% in taxable income.
It's all taxable.
All taxable.
Everything.
That's right. But we have the American Jobs Creation Act, which is allowing that, you know, temporary one, but that's just for foreign-controlled corporations. That's number 2.
So number one
REITs, REITs, nothing.
Nothing. And there's no, and that's not an issue?
That's not an issue. I mean, that's not part of any of your legislation that got changed.
Okay, so on number one, there's no policy decision for Oregon.
The policy decision for you is to connect to the federal tax treatment. We're not connected to that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Right now, we are allowing a 70 or 80% deduction for those dividends that are received from a REIT.
And this would say no, we would allow zero.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
Is that one of the reasons, this seems so simplistic to ask that question, but I just want to get it straight in my head. Is that one reason that the fiscal kind of levels out, is because this is a deduction that will no longer be allowed if we connect? In other words, if we're 70-80% and we connect with the feds and there's none on the REIT?
Yeah.
Or am I
right.
misunderstanding?
No, you're right.
No,
it's minus.
As far as the revenue impact, it's under the green box there, and it says eliminates Oregon's dividends received for certain types of dividends. And this is really just the REITs there.
Okay.
And so that's the additional 1.8 million in 05-07, 4 million, 4.3 million in 07-09, and 4.5 million in 2009-11. So I'm not assuming much growth in the REITs, you know, as far as the amount that could be transpiring. The issue, I will clearly state that there's just Department of Revenue has, they don't know what type of dividend received that they're actually seeing when they look at their data, because they just have dividend received deduction. You know, they have the amount that a certain corporation is claiming, but they don't know whether it's box H, you know, subsection 1, 2, 3, 4. They don't have any idea. So we can't really separate all of this out real easily. We have to rely some on federal data, because the federal government does do a better job of determining with the different types of dividends. And but the information we can get anyway so far here at Oregon Department of Revenue, they just have a tough time separating all this out. But they do feel like that this REITs are the majority of that dividend deduction that we've been seeing. And that is kind of the rise in it. And that's why it was part of a multi-state tax commission discussion. So the rest of them, Chairman, but Deckard, are not really that significant. And, you know, so I don't know if it's really worth it to go through them all. That's okay. But just recognize we have this is federal law, basically. This box H is the same. What is in Internal Revenue Code 243D? And so that's basically why we've connected to that section, which says these dividends will not be allowed a dividend deduction under federal law. We are going to be connecting with that, and that's everything that's in that box there.
Okay, so you're saying 3 through 9
are really not
a great deal of activity, so
correct.
We don't need to be.
And even under 8 and 9, I don't mean to confuse you more, but the pink box really represents ones that we currently currently do not receive a dividend deduction. Okay, so those are ones that basically with DISC, DISC and the FISC, which are the foreign sales corporations, DISC are the domestic investment and sales corporations, they both do not are not allowed a dividend deduction under current law. And that was something that Oregon took a stand on early in the 80s when we first started dealing with those sales corporations, and that's really leads you into that extraterritorial income exclusion argument. But originally, Oregon was not allowing foreign sales corporations or domestic or these DISCs to be allowed any dividend deduction. They were an entity that just basically they didn't recognize.
Okay, and so look, DISCs, and I probably should know this, but I don't. So, just in general, if you could give an example of what a DISC is, so that.
Well, you know, Senator Deckard, I'm not good at, you know, I'm not really an international, but it is dealing basically with sales corporations are created to deal with just the sales from certain, for corporations, they'll create a sales corporation just to categorize certain sales. So that's what you saw, those foreign sales corporations were just for the sales overseas.
Okay.
And so, you know, it basically was a way in which you could, have your sales categorized, you know, and they probably even have them in different countries, you know, of foreign sales corporations in order to deal with their sales in certain.
Speak them up.
Okay. Yeah, but the important point is we've never recognized them here in Oregon as far as being something that we should be allowing them an exclusion from income. We never gave them that exclusion from income, and we've never given them a dividends deduction for any dividends that are received from those foreign sales corporations or just.
Okay,
so that's the, I mean, I know this is a very confusing and complicated issue, and I don't want to, you know, go into a whole lot of detail, but I just wanted to make it clear to you that it is something we've been examining. Department of Revenue has been, you know, looking into this, and it is just a very, we do have a disconnect with certain elements, but we are trying to connect in this bill, and that's basically what you're seeing then in Section 17 and 18A, or taking those, in particular the REITs, and then the foreign control dividends from foreign controlled corporations, and saying in the future we're not going to be allowing the 70 or 80% dividend deduction. And then it also, in that section, provides that temporary 85% corporate dividend received deductions for controlled corporations. That's part of the American Jobs Creation Act 2004. So that is on your sheet here. It's the first one under tax reform and simplification for business on the second sheet. And that's the incentives to reinvest foreign earnings in the United States. That's the foreign control. That's the dividends received from foreign-controlled corporations. So you've got an additional $2.4 million in the 2005-07 biennium, $3.4 million in the 2007-09 biennium, and then in the 2009-11, $3.9, almost $4 million in that biennium. So this is additional revenue that is brought in because the federal government is incentive. You know, given an 85% dividend deduction is a huge incentive for corporations to be able to bring earnings back to the United States. But as it was discussed the other day, too, it has to be above a base level that they've already been repatriating back to their parent corporation. So it has to be, you know, a sizable amount. And so that's what you're getting in these first years. And then even if you look at the federal revenue impact for this provision, they say in the outer years that you would actually be losing revenue because the dividends would not be as high because you would have basically been depleting a supply of foreign earnings that are overseas, and then in the future your base level wouldn't be as high. But we are seeing additional revenue because we're going to basically now be taxing that dividends received, and we're not going to be allowing that 70 or 8% deduction.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, please.
Well, that led perfectly to my question, and that is, in the LRO report on the revenue impact, we didn't even attempt to forecast what that increased investment in manufacturing would do for the overall ability for us to raise money from taxation on those businesses and jobs that would be created by that reinvestment.
Senator George, that's correct. We have not done a dynamic analysis for this particular provision. Yeah. Okay. So then basically with the, I think I've pretty well covered all the issues surrounding the corporate dividends received deduction. Then you also have, just so everyone's clear, because there was some confusion in the beginning, this bill also does deal with the income tax benefits from the tsunami relief contributions. And this was H.R. 241, Public Law 109-1 of the federal law. Even though that was passed in 2005, in January of 2005, we do have provisions in this bill to connect to that. So basically, this is allowing then Oregon taxpayers to have contributions to any tsunami relief organizations be claimed. They could have claimed them in April 15th of this year for those contributions that were made up through January of 2005. And so this is really a wash. It doesn't have a revenue impact, you know, because it's a minus and then it's a plus. So for overall, for the 2005-07 biennium, it's zero impact. And this was just a temporary provision. And then just the effective date of the bill takes effect 90 days after the end of session. So basically, that's the bill itself. Now let's go through some more of these components, because this is, I don't think we've really gone through this sheet very well yet. Let's start in with just the front side. The very first page here is dealing with the things that we were automatically connected to of the federal legislation. So basically with that, you saw issues primarily dealing with depreciation. And so you see, first of all, the American Jobs Creation Act of 2003, you had depreciation changes as far as an expansion of 179 expensing and then an increase in the bonus depreciation. And so I've given you there in parentheses the CPA report section. So if you do want more information, some more details on that, you've got that. But I think I will just try to help people, I think, understand some of the talk and testimony that you've heard about, you know, the bill being overall revenue neutral and things like that. Well, it's because of these depreciation changes. And so they're really looking at this front side section, you know, this first page, and then the totals versus the back side in the totals. So that's why when you first have these depreciation changes, again, that causes a revenue loss immediately because you're basically allowing people to expense more initially. But then in the outer years, it's going to be positive because they're not going to have as much left in that basis of that property in order to have as a depreciation to claim. So that's why you see, like, say, in American Jobs Creation Act 2003, in 2003-2005 biennium, it's a reduction of $51 million. But in 2005-2007, you've got a positive $15.5 million. And then in 2007-2009, $25.7 million. So, I mean, you get the idea. It's a rolling, you know,
but
kind of...
But didn't that federal bonus depreciation, wasn't that a three-year temporary? So what would we be reconnecting to? I mean, it's phased out after 3 years. I don't understand what we'd be reconnecting to. I mean, that's gone from the federal books, the bonus depreciation.
Correct, Chairman Deckard. I mean, it would be very difficult if you thought you were going to actually go in there and change, you know. I mean, you could say, you know, they have to file them in returns or something, you know. I mean, I think things that have already passed, you're right. I mean, that's really what was happening there. Until the end of 2004, you could claim this bonus depreciation of 50%, and now you can't.
I guess my question is why there's a positive fiscal. I understand that the state's going to pick up money, but that's just a federal. It was a three-year, a good incentive that really worked, a bonus depreciation incentive that worked well. But I don't see how it would factor into our reconnect discussion, because really that's now gone from the federal books and it's back to the status quo that existed 3 years ago. And so why is that issue germane to our whole discussion on balancing? Or
I guess the important thing to think about with depreciation, which is different than a lot of these other components, but depreciation is basically you've just got the cost of the property. So if the property is $100,000, it's a question of when are you going to take that $100,000 as a depreciation expense.
Mm-hmm.
So all you're doing is changing the timing of this. So that's why you're seeing, you know, I mean, these positives are never going to be bigger than the negative, you know, because you've got to look at what is the overall impact from, and you can only depreciate, you know, up to $100,000. I mean, you know, as far as the value of the property. So that's why I think you're seeing the positives. It's just dealing with the timing of when you actually took that expensing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer it, or I don't know?
Yeah, I mean, I understand how depreciation, you can go into the out years because it's a property
right.
That's depreciating. I'll just have to think about it more of why, since that isn't really a policy choice. I don't know what the Oregon legislature could do, since the federal mm-hmm. law is now basically what it was 4 years ago.
Right.
I mean, even if, I don't know where the policy decision is for us. I mean, I understand you're going to pick up money.
Right.
But that's just because the federal law just... It was a temporary law.
Right.
But I'll just have to work through that, I guess, in my own head of why that would be a positive fiscal for Oregon in a reconnect bill.
Yeah. And let me clarify, too. The things that are on this first sheet, with the exception of one, which I'll highlight later, but they're already incorporated into current law. When you see the state forecaster come in and give you your estimates, these are already in there.
Yeah, so why is it on our sheet?
Well, I'm just trying to help you understand what you've kind of done and the overall impact from this legislation, because it isn't just the, you know, I mean, it is side C, but, I mean, it's also you made choices last session to connect already with certain provisions and depreciation being one of the big ones. So this is just trying to help you see, okay, since last session and when we were in this is, these, you know, measures have passed and this is a component of what you've done,
mm-hmm.
You know, what the legislation at the federal level has done for your corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And, Mr. Chair, these numbers are not part of LISBA's revenue impact from the bill.
Right.
This is just more background.
Right.
Background.
This is the result of federal legislation, but the bill itself is what's side two.
Okay.
So that.
Yeah.
And that's only the decisions you make on connection.
Okay, that's helpful. So this is just more kind of background information,
right.
A historical look at where we've been
at the legislation in general, the federal mm-hmm. legislation.
Okay. Yeah.
But also, Mr. Chair, you could, some of these provisions that we have automatically connected to, because you specifically said that, you know, the disconnect didn't apply to those things, you can always come back to those. I mean, the depreciation's kind of come and gone, but mm-hmm. some of the other issues, it's certainly within the purview of the legislature to review those automatic reconnect points and decide if you want to continue those.
Okay. As we move down this list or something. Yeah.
And like initially when we started talking about the sales tax deduction, that wasn't part of House Bill 2542, so I put it on the front side of the sheet. And then once we added, had an add back added in, and that became part of the discussion, then it went to the second side of the sheet. So just so everyone's clear. But I'll just kind of highlight, because I know we're, you know, getting short on time, but just to everyone, so everyone's clear on the corporate side, which is that first section, what you have totaled as far as all those different depreciation changes is from the American Jobs Creation Act 2004 is a loss then of $2 million in the 2003-05 biennium, a loss of $19.7 million in the 05-07 biennium, and then a positive there in the 2007-09 biennium of about $2 million. Now, again, the big loss is, again, a new depreciation. The American Jobs Creation Act allowed not the bonus depreciation to continue, but the 179 expensing to continue for two more years. So that is where you're getting the loss in a $20 million than the 05-07 biennium. So, and then the another major act that we had passed is the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act. And there is, you've had testimony in the health savings accounts, and then you've had testimony on the federal subsidies, which are on the second sheet. But one point to recognize here is that after I started examining this act more, I found that we actually could quantify the indirect tax effect from reductions in employer costs. So basically with this provision, it was allowing employers to have the option. Did they want to continue these drug plans for their retirees, or did they want to have them go to Medicare? And so basically, if this was looking at those choices that employers were going to be making, and they would be making a choice that was profit maximizing for the corporation, so this is an indirect reduction in employer costs from not having those health care costs and those drug plans to maintain. So then you're going to see additional positive revenue to those for those corporations, because they'll be paying more in taxes, so they have less costs. So that's what you're seeing then in this additional $7.3 million in 2003-05 biennium, and then $12 million in the 05-07 biennium, and $14.9 million in the 2007-09 biennium. Now, this is one component that will get incorporated into the May forecast, and it has not been incorporated into any forecasts prior to this. Then you've got the personal income tax revenue component. So with the American Jobs Creation Act of 2003, this is basically just looking at the small companies that would also be having that increase in 179 expensing and the bonus depreciation in 2003. And then I also had calculated in the federal tax liability reduction from having basically Oregon would have a smaller tax subtraction then from having lower federal tax liability. And so that's what you've got then in positive revenue there, $28,000, $11,000, and $19,000 in the outer bieniums. So then another the major component in the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act of 2003 is these health savings accounts and establishing these new health savings accounts. And so this is basically something that we've already connected to, just due to the language that was in our reconnect bill from last session. So under current law, we're connected with medical savings accounts and any other like-kind savings accounts in which the health savings accounts falls into. So that's why you're seeing this on the front side versus the back side, which you've already had testimony that some people would like to have you disconnect with these or put some sidebars on it.
Would that show up in the forecast, these numbers?
Yes. This is incorporated into the forecast, the health savings accounts, as a reduction.
Mm-hmm. As a reduction in the forecast will be reduced down based on...
Yes, Senator Decker.
Stay connected to that.
Right, because we're saying that this is already current law on this front side. So that's why the forecast already has this, 05-07 biennium of negative $3.7 million and then the $4.6 million in 2000.
And that was in the March forecast.
Correct.
That was forward to the May.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, the only thing that hasn't gone incorporated on this front side are those indirect tax effects from the reduction in employer taxes. So those will be added to the corporate tax revenue forecast. Okay. Okay, then the Working Family Tax Relief Act of 2004, then again, that's just so you know, recognize that that act basically did extended that, you know, $1,000 child care tax credit and the marriage penalty relief. And so then I took all of those various provisions and looked at the federal tax liability reduction and then looked at how much additional revenue we'd have here in Oregon from having a smaller tax subtraction. So that's really about $12 million in the 05-07 biennium and $13 million in the 07-09. But again, that's already been incorporated into the forecast. Okay, so then on your next page here, this starts in with your bigger components that you've been having testimony on, which are basically your in the CPA's report, the recommendation C. And the two big ones are right up there at the top in the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. You have the repeal of the extraterritorial income exclusion. And so this is a phase-in of that elimination. So just so everyone's clear, it doesn't become fully phased in until 07. So it's in 04, there's nothing. In 05, it's 80%. In 06, it's 60%. So basically that exclusion doesn't come fully into effect until 07. So that I've given you the 09-11 biennium impact on this page because some of these are still being phased in, and I just wanted to make sure everyone was clear exactly of what the future kind of looked at. So this was the big trade-off in Congress as far as, you know, needing to have an ETI exclusion repeal, but then the additional deduction was allowed then for the qualified production activities. And so as far as people are saying you could get additional revenue and whatnot, this is really what they've been talking about as far as this the difference, and this was the major component in the minority report on House Bill 2542, was the deduction for income attributable to U.S. production activity. So basically, you know, 507 biennium, it's a reduction of $18.7 million with our connection to it, $27.7 million in the 07-09 biennium, and then 2009-11, $41.6 million. So the reason why, I mean, as you can see, in the future, this is really the long-term issue for you because in the future, this is growing, and this is when it's actually out there in fully implemented is in the 2009-11 biennium, and that's why you see the $41 million out there. But when it's fully implemented in 2010, it's a 9% of the production activities that a corporation has that actually gets that deduction. Then if you look at some of the other components of the 2004 American Jobs Creation Act for corporations, where some S-corporate law changes, and those had an impact of less than $1 million each biennium. Then there were some other provisions dealing with livestock sold, and those, again, were pretty small provisions. But then you come under the tax reform and simplification for businesses. Then you come into that investment to reinvest foreign earnings in the United States, and that's what we talked about with the dividends received. So basically, this is one of the bigger positives to the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. And that's, you know, $2.5 million in the 05-07 biennium, $3.4 million in the 2007-09 biennium, and then 2009-11, $4 million. Now, the miscellaneous tax reform provisions are just a variety of other kind of technical ones dealing with things like recharacterization overall domestic losses, applying some of those look-through provisions for dividends from non-controlled corporations, interest expensing allocation rules. So all of those add to an additional revenue loss of $3 million in the 05-07, $5.5 million in the 07-09, and $15 million in the 09-11 biennium. So, and then there's positive revenue provisions there, and those are ones that, you know, you guys have already kind of somewhat talked about when you talked about the provisions relating to the tax sheltering in your tax amnesty bill. So that's where the IRS has kind of identified those different reported transactions that are considered tax shelters. So, and then you've got things like the deduction for charitable contributions of vehicles, that kind of thing is also incorporated in there. So those are all positive revenue-generating measures that will flow through here to Oregon. And so that's an additional $10.7 million in the 0507 biennium, $10.8 million in the 0709, and $11 million in the 0911 biennium.
Okay, so we just have a few more minutes.
Sure.
So let's hit the Medicare, prescription drug, and anything else people want to hit real quick.
Yeah.
The Medicare, so let's talk a little bit about that.
Okay. So the major component here that was part of the minority report was excluding federal subsidies for certain drug plans from income for employers. So basically what this is that that Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act allows corporations to receive subsidies, Medicare subsidies, for keeping their prescription drug plans for their retirees. Now, if they choose not to, you know, keep those drug plans, then their retirees go on Medicare. But if they keep them, they get these subsidies. What this does is not only did Congress give them the subsidies, but then they said, okay, now you don't have to report these subsidies on your income, on corporate taxable income. So they gave them an exclusion from this subsidy in their corporate taxable income. So they basically reduced their corporate taxable income base. Now, if you connect with that, then you're basically saying that, you know, without those subsidies, you would be, you know, down here, but with those subsidies included, you'd be up here as far as how much gets portioned of that corporate taxable income to Oregon. Again, we're portioning on our, you know, payroll and our property and basis, and so that's really what this is doing, is saying, okay, if we're going to connect with this Medicare prescription drug plan, then we're going to also be allowing this exclusion, and that's a reduction of $5 million, the 0507 biennium, $8.6 million, the 0709 biennium, and $10 million in the 0911 biennium. And so this is slightly different than what was on the House side as far as revenue impact. This is the only one I've revised. But I just looked at the timing of when corporations would be making these decisions, and I moved it out more to the outer bienniums. So are there any questions on that component? I know we haven't talked about it very much, and you haven't really had much testimony on it. But basically, it's, you know, it's these Medicare subsidies, and the Department of Revenue went and kind of discussed with folks in order to be able to determine whether or not they could add that back, because it is an exclusion, and so it sometimes exclusions are hard to identify, but the Medicare is going to be tracking all these different corporations that are going to be getting their subsidies, and so that's something that could be shared with the Department of Revenue in order to give them audit ability to be able to verify that these federal subsidies are being added back.
Okay, so if you could have the grandparent one and the civil rights tax relief one, and then any others that people want, because I know we have just 2 minutes left.
Sure. Civil rights is pretty straightforward. It doesn't have much as far as revenue impact. It's just for personal income tax filers. They can claim their attorney fees for civil rights cases on their tax form as a deduction. And then we've already talked about the sales tax. And then with the Military Family Tax Relief Act, just so everyone's clear, we will be connecting with all those provisions. That's additional death benefits. So we're currently disconnected in terms of we just have a $3,000 deduction because we only get 50% of the federal level. And so the death benefits are going to be at $12,000, and then you give a full benefit, so that entire $12,000 would be removed from taxable income here in Oregon.
And can we skip down to the expansion of the definition of qualifying child?
Sure. And so this one is basically dealing with connecting with a broader definition, and so you're going to be allowing grandparents, you know, step parents and things to be able to claim those children and a working family child care tax credit. and that's a reduction there of roughly $3 million a year, or $3 million a biennium, beginning in 05, 07 biennium.
Right, right. Anything else that we missed? Questions or...
Well, we'll go through more of this, I'm sure. If you have questions, let me know.
So we're going to put this away for about a month here. This is the last time we're going to... This will be part of just the final as we decide the budget, but appreciate the overview of, and I know that people are ready to answer any questions that folks have on Reconnect, and we'll return to this in a month or two. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2542 and adjourn the committee until Monday.
Mr. Brown, I don't want to return to anything in a month.